Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Rockfin, Odyssey, Band.video, Vigilante.tv, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks a million. We appreciate your support. We know we couldn't do it without you. If you want to connect with me, the website is theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Macroaggressions. Hey, if you are living in a place that's really, really cold in the winter and you are thinking you might want to get away for a week, well, I've got just the thing for you. First week of February, February 6th through the 10th, 2023, Acapulco, Mexico. Come join me at an Acapulco. I'll be speaking there along with Ron Paul, David Icke, Dan Dix, Del Bigtree, Mark Passio, Andrew Kaufman, Dr. Carrie Madej, Larkin Rose. It'll be a pretty good group of people. If you've got kids, bring your kids. They've got a kids camp for them. If you want to learn about crypto, there'll be crypto guys there with a crypto stage. They'll be talking about all that. Hey, look, it's a great place. I've been fortunate enough to speak there a couple of years. You leave feeling inspired. If it's something that is up your alley or you're interested in it, just go to anarchapulco.com and use the promo code macro when you're buying your tickets, and you'll save yourself a little bit of money. And look, there's worse places to be the first week of February. Also, thank you to our newest sponsor, Legal Shield. Thank God that Tony Ordeburn hooked me up with Legal Shield. I think this was a huge home run for me personally, for the show. I think you guys should probably check this out. I'll tell you what it is. It's the collective buying power of all of us directed towards powerful legal firms in your area. You're going to get access to a lawyer, an average lawyer that works with Legal Shield, 22 years of experience. So you're not just getting some kid right out of college. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. They've been in business for 50 years. It's available in Canada and the United States only. So all of you international listeners, I apologize. But for those of you that are interested in checking this out, we built our own landing page. You can go to www.don'tgetpushedaround.com and just check it out for yourself. It's $30 a month. It's $1 a day, okay? You get access to a legal firm in your area. And my suggestion is this: get yourself some paperwork done. Get the stupid things that you have to do, that you don't want to do, that you know are going to cost you $1,000 each. Get yourself a last will and testament. You know, I just read on TMZ that Aaron Carter, the singer rap, died, and it said died without a will. And I thought, geez, you know, I've been doing these, been talking about this lately, and I feel like maybe people should pay attention. get yourself a will, get one for your spouse as well, get yourself a financial power of attorney, get yourself a medical power of attorney. It's $1,000 for each one of these documents if you just go on your own to a law firm. But I'll tell you what, you don't have to worry about that anymore. If you're a member, it's covered in the membership fee. The first thing you do when you get your membership is you'll have an app on your phone. Call the local law firm in your area. Say, I want to set up an appointment. I want to come in and knock out a couple things. I have some legal documents that I want to get taken care of with you guys. They will be happy to help you with that. Also, from this point on, if you have a contract that you think that, you know, before you sign it, send it to your attorney. It's what you're paying for. You're just not paying as much as everybody else is to do it, but you're paying for it. So look, the wealthy have this, okay? They don't sign anything without their attorneys taking a look at it first. If your job is asking you to sign some new paperwork that is maybe medical related, having to do with some sort of, you know, they want you to have some sort of injection or something, send that to your attorney, okay? This is not our area of expertise. I'm not an attorney. You aren't either. Send it to the attorneys, have them take a look at it. They'll give you some feedback on this. This is the way we level the playing field. And as they say, equal justice under the law in America, right? 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 Yeah, right. Yeah, that does not happen. Those who have the money make the rules. Those that have access to great attorneys, they play a different game than everybody else. Well, guess what? We just leveled the playing field. So do this. Do yourself a favor and just at the very least, go to the website. The link is going to be in the description. Just go down to don'tgetpushedaround.com. See for yourself. See what you think. Also, Chemical Free Body. Thank you guys so much. Tim James over there, he's the best. You know, he comes on, he gives us all this great advice on how to improve our health for free. Vitamins are a scammy business. We know that. You know, half of them don't work. You never know what you're getting. I know one thing, Chemical Free Body has been fantastic. Their products actually work. Tim James is so convinced of that, he's got a double your money back price guarantee. So if they didn't work for you, he'll fix it. But they're fantastic. They're as the name implies, there's no chemicals in there. Tim is obsessed with making sure that the quality is the highest. I've been on the product for 2.5 years. I feel fantastic. I drink a green 85 drink every single morning. And they have something else like a detox package. So, you know, listen, you change your oil in your car, right? Maybe flush your body, flush your system out every now and then, right? Do this. Go to chemicalfreebody.com and just take a look. See what you think. If you find something you like and you want to buy it, use the promo code MACRO on your way out to save yourself some money. They have free shipping inside the United States. And I think you'll be happy. I love the products. Obviously, Tim has been on the show many, many times. He's a fantastic guy. We truly believe in him. And I'm happy to support his, to associate with his company. Well, if you guys have watched The Union of the Unwanted or listened to the show, we have a returning guest from The Union of the Unwanted many, many, many times. I think you've been on probably just about as many times as I've been on. Every time I'm on, Matt Raymer's on. So we're excited to have Matt Raymer. He is the founder and CEO of ContentSafe, and he is here to talk to us about all things digital security, all things, you know, locking up your content, making sure that these bastards in big tech can't mess with us. So it is my pleasure to talk to you, the great Matt Raymer. Good to see you, Matt. How are you? How are you feeling?
Doing good.
Good.
Yeah.
How are the Philippines?
It's great. I mean, love him or hate him, the new president basically came in and kind of elliptically said, we're going to try to forget about all this COVID stuff.
Good.
He didn't say that, but in effect, that's what he's done, is he's told everyone, nobody has to get a jab. Nobody has to wear a mask. It's up to you. And, you know, basically the previous president, I'll be careful what I say. I didn't really like him all that much.
Yeah. Didn't he have like hit squads that went around on motorcycles and shot drug dealers? Or was that, a little bit more?
See, that's the thing. Philippine politics, and I want to correct some expats, even please, those who've lived here for quite some time. I've lived here 25 years. And a lot of expats are full of shit. They don't really understand how the country works. I'm blessed, I guess, with having family that are kind of like somewhere in the upper middle tier of society here. So I've been able to talk not only with people like at the very top, I've actually had dinner with the head of the National Security Agency here. And one of my former business partners is like really, really high up there, gets called into the presidential palace regularly, actually knows the new president by name. They know one another. And I also know the people on the opposition side. I have friends that opposed the previous president and the current president. And, you know, I feel like I understand society better here than most expats would. And it's complicated. What was happening under Duterte was happening before Duterte. That's a fact.
Okay.
But that being said, he was the most vocal and he admitted to it.
Gotcha. So they always took a hard line on that sort of stuff, but it's, I mean, look, in America, we don't get too much news about what's going on in the Philippines, as you know. But but that makes headlines when they're like, President of the Philippines authorizes people to murder drug dealers. You're like, that's one way to take care of drug dealers.
In my little city, before the lockdowns, before Duterte, if you were picking, this is complicated too. If you were stealing cell phones and you got a little out of control and you stole the wrong person's cell phone, you would see hands, severed hands hanging from the pedestrian flyovers.
Ooh.
Yeah. That's how intense it could be.
Okay.
And supposedly they stopped the practice of dumping headless, handless, footless bodies in, because I live up in the mountains.
Right.
There's this particular place, maybe about 45 minutes from where I live, that they would dump the bodies over the cliffside. Supposedly they stopped that, but recently I heard it's resumed again.
Yikes.
Yeah. Yeah. It can be pretty intense. What we tell people who come here is mind your own business. Don't get involved in anything that you wouldn't get involved in if you were in your home country.
Yeah, that's probably
and you'll be okay. Yeah, you'll be okay.
I talked to, I've got a buddy who's a developer in Nicaragua. Well, he's a developer all over the place, but he's got a project in Nicaragua. And I said, well, how is it there? Is it safe? He said, you just mind your own business. He said, we as outsiders coming in to work in this country, we don't have an opinion on the way a government is run.
Absolutely.
Because to have an opinion is not our place. And so we just have no opinion on how it's run. And that works out better. I said, okay, that's good to know.
And my observation is that the central government here does not control the country. There are provincial governments. And unofficial governments, some people call them warlords. usually these quote unquote warlords occupy the governor's position or a mayor's position, or they're official. But, you know, to an outsider, you might call them warlords, and they decide what's going to happen in their region. And often, it's actually a little bit better. I mean, they've talked about implementing a federal system like the US has, because right now, technically, there is no regional autonomy except in like Muslim Mindanao. They've talked about implementing something like the US has, but really, in reality, it already exists de facto. And it's actually better than what the US has in some sense. I mean, yes, how could you say it's better? You got hands hanging from flyovers. In a sense, it's better, because if the local populace says that they don't like something, generally speaking, the warlord can't do anything about it.
Hmm.
And it won't happen because the populace says we don't want that.
Well, if I was given the choice today between the current American government and all of the crimes and shenanigans that they're up to, And a secondary option was, we're just going to replace them with the actual mafia, I'd be like, I'll take the mafia.
Yeah, really. I've actually thought the same thing myself. It's like, you know, at least in old school mafia, if you knew which way to walk, what street to walk on, what to say, what not to say, you're going to be perfectly fine.
Right.
Just don't run up against them and try to, you know, compete with them.
Right.
But the way it stands with this global sort of mentality of top-down control, they can make life hell for everybody.
Yeah. And it's funny because I just, you know, I read the two new Whitney Webb books, One Nation Under Blackmail, and she talks about this intersection of organized crime and government and how they work together, and the lines really get blurred between who's what, you know. And she's talking about like in '30s and in New York City, and in the '40s when they needed the Italians, you know, like, hey, we got World War II going on, like we're gonna invade Italy, and we're gonna kind of need your help. And it's like, oh, now you need our help. Oh, okay, well, we can maybe help you out, but you're gonna have to get our guys out of prison first. And they're like, okay, well, we'll get your guys out of prison first. It's like, okay, so rule of law matters until it doesn't, right? So when we need you, we'll pull you guys out of prison and have you help us out. But yeah, that line between government, you said it was like, well, he, you know, they kind of like a warlord, but also kind of like a governor. I was like, what's the difference?
Prince.
You know, like, really?
We'll look at New York.
Right.
Right. Because, right. And, you know, with Cuomo, he actually seemed to be a old school gangster.
Yeah.
Just the way he spoke and everything.
Yeah. 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 And it's funny. I mean, in the Trump, you know, you look at the Trump history and you go, well, who Trump's attorney was Roy Cohn. And it's like, Roy Cohn represented the mafia. You
that's
know,
right.
He was running. When your attorney is running sexual blackmail operations as well, you've got a problem. Like, Roy Cohn was running these entrapment ops, and, you know, before Jeffrey Epstein, you know, he was doing it before it was cool. And that's your attorney. So it's like, organized crime, organized government, what's the difference?
Right. Yeah, I don't really see any difference between the two at all.
These days, yeah, it's tough. It's blurry. Well, I'm curious, because so you're in the tech, I mean, you do all kinds of things, but you're in essentially in the tech business. You're watching, and you're in the personal freedom business.
Right.
So you've been watching the tech industry from the same perspective that we've been watching it from, which is these guys are no good. These guys that can explain. I'm just to give us the lowdown. I know a lot of other content creators either listen to or watch this show, but talk about a little bit about Content Safe, because what you're doing, I think, is very beneficial for a lot of people that work in the field of data and really are kind of concerned about, you know, we just mentioned, you get on the wrong side of the mafia, you know, and you get on the wrong side of the big tech mafia, and it's two bullets in the back of the head, and you never saw it coming either. Your channel is eliminated.
Right.
So it's a digital execution. So what does Content Safe do that makes this, or at least adds a barrier of protection for us?
Well, I have a lot of different ways to try to explain Content Safe, but I'll start with what I would consider the most basic technical explanation. We are a media redistribution service. So we provide a bridge from corporate, large scale video hosting, and we are also dabbling in audio hosting as well, over to alt or alternative video platforms. So we support all the major video platforms now: BitChute, Odyssey, Rumble, band.video, we support them as well. And Brighteon, I could keep listing, but but yeah, we support all those. And we allow content creators to follow whatever pattern that they like to follow in their work. So if you presently upload to YouTube, I'm sorry for you if you do.
Right.
But we do support downloading the video automatically. And this is a software system. It's something I designed, and I've written probably 95% of the code myself. And it keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. which I'm actually, I have one developer who helps me, but I probably need another developer to really push to some areas I'd like to see this go. Other than that, what we do is we consult for content creators, helping them find different monetization strategies, helping them out with their websites. I do a lot of consulting for website optimization now, because one thing I've noticed, we actually picked this up before we got into Content Safe, but now that we've gotten into Content Safe, I see it. It's really important that you'll have a client who becomes very popular, and I have a client that is very popular, and he started talking about Ukraine back in February, and he had a very expensive hosting package on a major hosting company. Actually, this is his second hosting company he's been. He'd been on GoDaddy. He ditched them. He went to HostGator. When he started talking about Ukraine, instead of getting like half a terabyte or a terabyte of bandwidth a month, he shot to 100 terabytes a month of bandwidth. That's insane amount of data.
Yeah.
And HostGator, he had an unlimited bandwidth package, but you could, so what? You got an unlimited bandwidth package. Well, at the same time, that server can't handle that.
Right.
So when he would do a live stream, the server goes down.
Mm.
Stays down the whole time that he's doing the live stream and barely can just sputter back to life after the live stream goes offline. Well, what we did, one, HostGator tried to fix this for 6 months and they couldn't. So they went with another service to help filter the data, but that still didn't really do it. He was still going down during live stream. So what we did with him was we looked at the way his site had been built. And over the course of a month, we went from he went with this Cloudflare service, which, you know, Cloudflare, I could probably spend an hour talking about the ups and downs of Cloudflare.
Mm-hmm.
But he went with Cloudflare. It went from 100 terabytes a month to 10 terabytes a month. That's still a lot. Yeah. 10 terabytes a month is still a lot. Well, we brought it from 10 terabytes a month to 200 gigabytes a month.
Okay. So it's architecture, right? Is that it?
Yes.
That sometimes you can just have a poorly architected, built, laid out site, and it's like,
right,
you can move this from streaming platform to platform, but your house is built with shitty quality wood. It's you're not going to be able to add any floors onto this thing.
You know, to be sort of merciful to a lot of people who do web design, people aren't really taught, if they were formally trained or they didn't read, just how important website optimization is. And I know I've heard this from people who make a lot of money in marketing. Okay. I'm not going to name any names,
right,
but they make a ton of money, six figures a year in marketing. And you ask them about website optimization and they say, doesn't matter. You go look at their website. They score, say, a 20 out of 100 on Google Page Speed. What does matter? Because it affects how people perceive the site. If it takes 30 seconds, 60 seconds, 120 seconds to load your website.
Yeah, it's bad.
That's not good. That's bad.
Yeah, because it sends the message, if you don't pay attention to this rather obvious detail in front of your face, and it's the first thing that I see when I get there, then are you going to be able to really pay attention to details on the other components of your business? And
right,
it's, maybe it's not the best thing in the world to judge somebody, but it's something that you're going to get judged on, whether it's fair or not fair, right?
Right, right, right. I mean, there is a point in which, you know, you've got your trolls out there that they're going to try to snipe at you any old way that they can. And you do need to gauge what can I do versus what I can't do. And just live with the fact that some people say, well, I want to cancel my subscription because your website loads too slow. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's kind of a petty reason to cancel a subscription to a content creator whenever how many people actually go to the website? Not really that many. Most of them are on the video platform side.
Right.
Right. But still, if you can, if you have the means to optimize, optimize, right?
Yeah. And are we talking search engine optimization or just everything? Well,
page optimization is what I'm referring to right now. So for instance, a web page based on the way browsers work should really never have much more than a megabyte of data on the initial page load. Because then people who view from their mobile or their desktop get the same experience loading your front page. Mm. But it's not unusual, especially high quality content creators. I'm not talking about guys who just, got into the game a few months ago. I'm talking about folks like you who've been doing it for years.
Right.
I will go to their website and I kid you not, sometimes it's 50 megabytes of data on the front page.
Yeah.
And if you were on a smartphone, that thing's going to take forever.
Yeah.
So, one thing we do is we help content creators have an efficiently loading main page. And we can also give them input as far as copywriting, because one of my business partners is a copywriter. And we can reach out and do SEO types of things as well. We're kind of a full service shop.
Cool.
But, Content Safe is the redistribution service, but we also offer these other things.
For contentsafe.co is the website for those that want to go check it out. It's not my area of expertise. When it comes to the tech stuff, I hand that over to Tony Merkel, who is my partner
in Macro Aggressions,
and I go, please just do what you can so that I don't have to think about this. Because if I get in there, I'm always afraid I'll go in there and break. I've built a website before and it worked fine and I did it okay. But I know that if a professional took a look at it, they'd be like, what is this garbage? You did it all wrong, which I'm sure I did. But I wasn't dealing with a ton of traffic, but I get intimidated by that stuff. I'm going to break it. I'm going to do something to it that's wrong. But it's nice to have you as an option for people that are out there to say, well, hey man, just to, can you take a look at my site and tell me, am I doing things wrong? And is there some sort of modifications? Where can you help me with this? Let me ask you this, since we're talking about the behind the scenes type stuff. I think it's fair to say that data is the new gold.
Oh, absolutely. Let me tell you an anecdote.
Please.
I had a client. Actually, he's still a client, but he's not with the same company. He was working with a company that made boxing gloves with pressure sensors and motion sensors in them. Mm-hmm. And I asked him once, hey, how much are you going to sell a pair of these for? And he said, actually, I don't know how much we're going to sell them for, and it doesn't really matter. We're going to sell the data off of the gloves, and that's how we're going to make all the money.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what he told me.
Yeah, give them the razor blade and sell them the razors.
Right. Right. It doesn't really matter how much the gloves cost.
Interesting. So I wonder about this, because we're in this new digital age, and we've got TikTok. Let's use this as an example. TikTok, I'm sure, I don't know, I don't have it on my phone because I feel, from what I've read, it's just an app that's sending all of your data to the Chinese.
Back to Beijing.
Yeah, right, to the Chinese government for that.
Same thing.
I mean, frankly, I would be, if they wanted to take a look at my data, I would bore them to death. But still, it's not theirs to look at, so I don't really want that. But is that true? Is it really just taking all your data and sending it back there? And does it do? Can they really make? What can they
do? You can't really look at this as you only.
Right.
What's the bigger, more important picture is the aggregate and averages of people that they collect the data from, not really the individual. I mean, of course, they could possibly get some things from you as an individual, like Amazon or Facebook listening to your calls or your conversations. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, I've heard so many anecdotes from friends about them saying something in a conversation and it shows up in their ads in Facebook that afternoon.
Yeah.
So it does happen. So they can target you individually, but I would say that there's more value in the larger picture of how masses of people think or behave.
Mm. So, but so maybe like, let's take TikTok out of this, but let's talk about something a little bit more domestic for us, at least here in America, Facebook as an example.
Right.
So Facebook is taking all of this information, genius creation by InQtel, the venture capital arm of the CIA.
Right.
But to get you to populate this site, your page with the things that you like, either early on adding them to your profile, pictures, information, or cumulatively over the course of your membership with Facebook, you're liking this or you're making a comment about that. So it feels like to me that they're building like almost a digital voodoo doll of you, right?
Yes.
All the things that you like, and then they can take that needle and they can stick it wherever they want and make
good analogy.
Kind of, you know, it's not a perfect representation of you, but it represents you to the best that they can. And then you react if they stick a pin in you, right?
Do you ever listen to Aaron and Melissa Dykes?
Yes.
I recall right after the Trump election that they did a set of videos on how data mining had led to the election of Trump, by selectively finding what topics would spur the strongest reaction from people.
Mm.
And I think that's the voodoo doll, right? That's the voodoo doll. And the beauty and the horror of machine learning, and this is a side topic worth talking about. The beauty of machine learning is its ability to find patterns that humans would not notice.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got your input variables and it's going to tell you, okay, this percentage of the time, this type of input produced this kind of output. And that's valuable if you're thinking about from an action standpoint. How do I need to tune my messaging to get the effect I'd like to get?
Yes. Okay. So if you're trying to make everybody happy about your product, you do one thing. If you're trying to get them anxious and angry and...
Right.
And I would suggest that probably led to the reason why Facebook expanded that from just a simple like to all of the different emojis where you can be happy, angry, crying, this, that. And so now you've got 7 or 8 different variations on how you feel as opposed to just one or two.
Right.
Thumbs up, thumbs down or whatever. I don't even know. Or maybe did they have, I don't, dislike button. I think they took that off on YouTube. Did they ever have it on Facebook? Maybe they didn't. I don't know. I don't remember. I'm barely on Facebook anymore. I don't remember.
Me too. I was actually one of the first people to jump onto Facebook back in the 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
But the more I learn about, you know, the manipulation that goes on there, I only post, like, I have a meetup with friends on Zoom once a week. I post the event there.
Yeah.
That's it. I don't do anything else on Facebook.
I have scaled that way down. They put me in Facebook jail for stupid stuff that I'd done 2 years earlier, and I would just be like, whatever. I mean, I get it. It's their platform. If they want to do that and scare off their customers, I guess it's,
well, you know. See, this is why one of the things I'm working on for Content Safe is replacements for corporate IT structures.
Okay.
And this is like it's not really us that are doing it. We're more consulting with someone else who's doing it. Have you heard of the Pirate Box Project?
Yeah.
Thomas Friedman. He's building these little appliances, different. Some of them are on high-end USB sticks. Some of them are on Raspberry Pis.
Yeah.
And we're actually building out specs for whole servers that run the PirateBox software.
Is this IPFS-based?
Yeah, IPFS, but we're also mixing in a couple other types of technology that we think will give us the ability to do social networking or tying in people together. One is called a Scuttlebutt. Scuttlebutt is a protocol for what's called the Rumors protocol. And it allows these little clusters or nodes to form without servers. And they can be as big or as small as you'd like. And they can be, not totally offline, but you could like use it just off of a stick and connect ad hoc. It can be ad hoc rather than continuously connected.
Gotcha.
So it's built for a censored internet. That way you're always a moving target in the worst case. The other thing is a search technology called YACY. That's YACY. It's a fairly mature project, started like around 2012. And it provides a distributed search engine.
Mm.
So we're working on tying all these pieces together into the PirateBox.
Have you been talking to Ernest Hancock?
Oh, yeah. Ernie got me onto this. I knew about IPFS before I met Ernie.
Okay, yeah.
And I knew that it was going to be something significant, so I had been following it. And honestly, we had talked 3 or 4 years ago about making that our launch product.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some obvious hurdles you have to get over before you can get that to be a large scale technology.
Mm.
It is in a sense already quite big. Cloudflare hosts gateways to IPFS along with Infura and a few other gateway services. So this has gotten to be quite big. In fact, in some circles, it's actually replaced what you would call old school piracy.
Really?
Yeah, really. Because have you ever heard of LibGen?
Mm-mm. No.
Now, LibGen is a pirated book portal.
Okay.
It's got
my books are on there getting stolen.
Probably. almost everything you could find in digital is there.
Cool.
And it's hundreds of terabytes of books. And it's all available via IPFS.
Well, I mean, I heard of IPFS from Ernie, and mm-hmm. Ernie's talking to me about, well, that's how we back up all of James Corbett's stuff. You know, that's how we,
right.
You know, this is why when YouTube kicks him off, all his stuff is backed up because we've already backed him up to this whole thing. And I'm listening to this, trying to, you know, nodding along, going, yes, you know, I'm like trying, because I don't understand the technology behind it all that well. But I do recognize that it is nice to have sort of a redundant copy of this stuff, because, you know, like when you wake up one morning and your YouTube channel's gone or whatever, as an example, because I've had that happen. Not that I was surprised, but if that were my only place where I had my videos, I'd be pretty pissed off.
Well, another way to look at it is IPFS allows the content creator to control his content. So the project with PirateBox, what we're doing is we're tying a interface into the PirateBox that it can then talk to ContentSafe. You upload all of your videos to the IPFS,
mm-hmm.
and then it can talk to ContentSafe, which then puts it out on BitChute and Odyssey and all that for you. So
gotcha.
You actually control your content. You have the original copy, and all these others are just duplicates you went for marketing purposes, right?
Gotcha.
I think that the service ContentSafe provides is not only helping a content creator protect his content, it's promoting alternative platforms.
Yeah. We got to do both. What is your take then? What happens if you put all your eggs in like the Amazon server basket, and then you get on the wrong side of, you know, you participate in wrongthink at some time in the future. Mm-hmm. And you wake up and Amazon, I'm assuming their terms of service say, if we don't like you, we can throw you off, right?
Right. So I personally have not used Amazon in like a decade. I did not like them. I did not like them. Even 10 years ago, I did not like them.
Yeah.
And that was mostly from a technical standpoint. I thought that they overcomplicated things.
Hmm.
I usually go with much more straightforward technology that doesn't have all of the strange, elaborate hoops that you have to jump through to run Amazon. But yeah, I think any content creator should think very carefully before hosting a website off of Amazon Web Services.
Where would you suggest they host it? If
I were going to go with anybody, I would go with a smaller, sort of medium-sized hosting company, someone like Linode, maybe Linode. And there's another one called, and I don't know how you're supposed to pronounce this, but it's, I pronounce it Vultr, Vultr. I primarily use Vultr.
Okay.
And they have, you know, international data centers. They have data centers outside of the US. They actually have data centers in really unusual places. Like they have a data center in Mexico City, mm-hmm. Which you don't really hear all that much about people going to Mexico for their data center.
No.
But I think that was kind of distributing to allow for growth in developing markets, maybe.
Are there certain countries where, I mean, are there certain places where you don't want your stuff hosted?
U.S.
country, U.S. is that
the
it?
U.S. Yeah, in the U.S. Yeah. You don't want it.
Well, I mean, because we know that Germany sends weird warnings now on social media, like this tweet might have violated some law in Germany. So, what countries are better to be?
Well, you know, actually, places here in Southeast Asia have the biggest reputation of not really caring about anything like that.
Okay.
But as far as connectivity and being accessible, Europe and the US are still the best as far as technologically, they're in the right position to reach the most people.
Mm-hmm. But their laws just make it more,
yeah,
like the technology's better, the locate, you know, all the infrastructure is better. But if we just get these damn politicians out of the way that make,
well,
the
you know, one thing that I think is kind of a reason to be optimistic. If you look at I think they call it the meme law, in Europe, in the EU, that they were going to start requiring everyone to check their photos before they could have them online. It's kind of like it was passed, but then it fizzled. There's really no enforcement. And I think it's because, one, despite the current level of technology, enforcement is really, really, really difficult on the internet unless you want to target particular people.
Yeah.
It's easy if you're targeted, but it's hard if you're just kind of like in the crowd.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, since we're talking digital stuff and we're talking about the crowd mentality, let's talk about crypto because we're in, look, we've had Mt. Gox years ago,
yes,
and that situation, we had BitConnect and the issues, right, with that. We've had certain cryptos get dragged into court. We had Ripple, we have Library/Odyssey,
yeah,
with their issues, mm-hmm, with court that just got wrapped up and found in the government's favor, of course.
Yeah.
And Jeremy Coffin's been on here before, and I met him at Anarchapulco when he was on the crypto stage there, and I like the guy and I like his philosophy and I love, yeah, all that stuff about but this crypto industry is, mm-hmm, growing up before our eyes. I write a book with Jeff Berwick. He has a company called the Dollar Vigilante and now another one called, right, the Crypto Vigilante. He was buying Bitcoin at $3. He's a guy that understands that. I do not understand it as well as Jeff. I am relatively new to it, you know, last 5 years or so. So is this just growing pains for a new technology? Are we seeing the sort of ebbs and flows that you get normally with this, where crypto kind of blows up and then it comes down and then there's a scandal and then it gets big and then it comes down and then there's a scandal? And it seems like we're going through sort of a boom and bust. I mean, you definitely want to have the stomach for this. If you're in this, for, you know, if you're having to say you need to have the stomach or you need to be a masochist or something, you know, I mean, you're going to go through some pain. Is this normal or are we seeing, you know, what are we seeing in the crypto markets currently? And where is this, you know, how much longer is it going to be this turbulent before it sort of smooths out, or does it ever?
I think it's possible. And I mean, talk about a complicated topic, because there's a lot of different ways you could look at this. I mean, the most skeptical, just as a, I need to say this just to be complete, but the most skeptical view of cryptocurrencies is that they're not, none of them are safe. And there are people out there who will even say that things like public key encryption has been broken at some level long ago and that we can't depend on it. I haven't jumped on that ship yet.
Right.
I'm just saying it for completeness so people don't, you know, come back and say, well, you know, public key encryption's broken. Well, maybe it is. I don't know. That hasn't been proven to me yet. There is a natural flow, though, to currencies and markets, and ups and downs, as we know, happen. Are they completely 100% engineered, or are they ridden? I think that there's a degree of engineering going on, and there's a degree of riding the wave going on. Mm-hmm. I think you can encourage, like with crypto, man, these 80% dumps, right?
It's a bit much.
Right. But let me tell you, I went through, because I've been in this game since around 2012, and I went through the 2017, 2018 spike and crash. And I remember thinking in 2017, watching that thing go up. And I remember looking at my family and saying, I don't like this. You know, other people were like, oh, wow, Bitcoin, that's 10,000, 12,000, 18,000. Right. I'm like, no, I don't like this. This is too fast. What I had imagined back then was a gradual increase in value.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that may have had some degree of social engineering involved in it.
Mm.
And the crash also had a degree of social engineering involved in it. And the attempt is to try to get people to wear out so that they can usher in a central bank digital currency.
Right. Right.
But the gotcha here is technology moves faster than government or private institutions can come up with methods to control that technology.
Right.
And that's what I think we're going to see playing out. You know, I'll be curious. I think the central bank digital currencies are going to do soft launches the end of this year and into next year.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't know exactly how they're going to do that. I haven't dug into it at all. But I think it will be a soft launch. I think that it'll be this gradual, like, okay, you can still use paper money, but we're going to offer a special deal here that if you use our digital currency, you get some benefit you don't get with paper money.
Right. Yeah, for right. Sure. Yeah. You could see it going one of two ways. You could go with the carrot method, which would be convert your paper U.S. Federal Reserve notes, known to be dollars now, into U.S. digital dollar, and we'll give you 2-for-1, you know, like, or 40% more, or whatever.
Right.
We'll match it, or we'll, you know, whatever.
Well, another anecdote from living in Southeast Asia, a pre-Asian economic crisis, nobody had bank accounts here. They were all unbanked. Mm-hmm. Only the top of society had banks. Whenever the Asian economic crisis happened, they wanted to get everyone to have bank accounts. So the way they did it was they offered 10, 12, 15% per annum interest on deposits.
Interesting.
Insane. It lasted for like 3, 4, maybe 5 years they did that, and then they slowly phased it out. But they're completely capable of doing that kind of thing to encourage people to use something that they want them to use.
I could see them incentivizing it that way with a very positive, uplifting, isn't this great? We're helping you out. And then after that went away, after the nice guy part went away, instead of the carrot, you make got it the mandatory stick, which is we're going to give you one-to-one dollars to digital dollars now. And in 90 days, we're going to give you, it's going to take one digital dollar to buy, or one US dollar to buy a half a digital dollar. And then it'll go down to a quarter. And then it'll go down to 10 cents. And pretty soon, your dollars will be worth zero. So get them into the system and get them into the system right now. You know, and right. So I can see them doing the nice guy routine, the get your Krispy Kreme donuts for every day for a year for the vaccine, laps right. around Talladega Speedway. Come get that, yeah, then go to the, or at the Joe Biden saying, I'll have OSHA come take your jobs away. You know, like,
yeah, you know, I think that this stick strategy has to come in cycles. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we're seeing with the vaccines. That's why I'm kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop on this. Mm-hmm. I know that right now they said that uptake in vaccinations is zero in the US. Nobody wants them.
Right.
I mean, if you were on the Pfizer train, you're probably going to keep getting boosters.
Right.
But, you know, a lot of people are like, no, I'm not going to do any more of this. They have to come up with some other way to get you to do that. And maybe what we're seeing is actually a movement between strategies to lead us down into a particular direction. So you got vaccines. You got changes in currencies. You got enhanced food regulation, like the thing with the Amish farmer recently.
Yeah.
You know, right? Trying to get food freedom away from people. So they're going to step through these strategies and do one at a time, two at a time. They're just kind of trying to shuffle us into the chute.
Yeah.
That, at least that's the way I perceive it.
No, it feels like that. Yeah, just sort of moving you down a little bit more down the system, remove a freedom here, encourage, you know, modify behavior in the vaccine situation.
Right.
Now we're going to change your currency. It's really hard to get your bearings when everything's changing around you. You don't know if your job's right. going to be there. You don't know what the interest rate you're going to pay. Do I buy a house now or do I buy a house next year? Shit, I don't know if the interest rates are going to be 9.5% next year. You know, so it's just uncertainty everywhere.
Right.
And I think that destabilizing feeling is psychologically traumatizing for people.
Yes.
And allows you to manipulate them in a very effective way.
And I think the only real countermeasure is awareness, right? Being aware, you know, for us, at least, we've been getting ready for this for a good 10 years.
Yeah.
And I can feel a difference between now and 10 years ago. But that said, we really don't, even though there are certain things we don't have access to anymore because the cost has risen. We still have a good standard of living. So I'm just wondering how aware we can get people to be, because this is going to require networked effort to handle this increasing pressure. We have to form communities. We have to come up with alternatives for food. I've heard it called the parallel polis, right? If you're a normie and you're now becoming red-pilled, all of the stuff that we anarchists were saying 10 years ago that the normies were saying was crazy, they're now starting to think, you know, that might not be a bad idea.
Yep. Yeah, we're starting to sound reasonable. Like a reasonable option. You know? And like, it's funny, I remember Berwick asked me, like, when first time I met him, actually, was on his show, The Anarchast. And he asked the first question. He says, the first question he always opens the interview with, when did you know you were an anarchist? And my answer was, as soon as I got clear about what an anarchist was and wasn't, soon as I understood that it wasn't Molotov cocktails and burning tires, but it was the Friday night entertainment at Anarchapulco was four big full-size buses pulling up and taking people from the hotel off to a nature preserve at the beach so that they could release baby sea turtles into the ocean at night so they don't get eaten by the birds. I was like, oh, you know, like that's anarchy. That doesn't mean no rules. It means no rulers. And once you get that through your head, you're like, oh, well, this isn't that crazy idea that the television told me about. This sounds like something more reasonable. And then when you start talking about anarchy, then you naturally come to like, well, we can't fix this system because the system is built. You talk about poorly architected, you know, the architecture of a website just being poor from the beginning. That's our government. So sometimes you just need to dump that website and build a brand new one, right? And so I'm thinking society, parallel economies, parallel societies, not necessarily like, oh, I'm going to go fix the Department of Education. It's like, no, we're doing the whole education thing wrong. Here's how you do it differently. And you just start, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, for me, I would say that what made the concept of being an anarchist most palatable and appealing was the work of Jacques Ellul. I always bring him up because I really admire his work. He was a French futurist. He was a lot of things, but let's just call him a futurist. And he was talking about technocracy in 1948. And his works had a great, profound effect on me. One of the things he would say is, I call myself an anarchist because I cannot imagine any other word to describe how I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been to the Anarchapulco twice. I spoke virtually at the third time. I'm going back again. Obviously, I was mentioned that at the beginning of the show. I always leave that conference feeling really I feel two ways. I feel sad because it's over, you know, because it's always such a fun experience to be around the people. But I also feel like inspired because I know that there are these people that are doing things differently. And I go, wow, I didn't even know that you could. I wouldn't even know where to begin to think about something like this, you know, where you meet a guy who's developed like a floating house. It like floats out in the ocean. You're like, you're out of your mind. He's like, for sure, but let me explain how it works. And you're like, great, you know. So I leave there feeling like these lunatics, you know, these, you know, supposed lunatics that are out there talking about a world without government, they're onto something. They're some of the smartest people I've ever met. And they're doing interesting things. And I leave, you know, I'm bummed because the week's over, like you are when a vacation's over. But I feel hopeful when I leave because I feel like those are the types of people that are going to actually pull us out.
I think that this is one of the weaknesses in the system's strategy is that they can't really give any hope to anybody. The only thing they can dispense is hopelessness. And dependency.
Yeah.
And
you've got everything at your fingertips, and the best you can offer is trying to scare the shit out of the public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's see. We've got the sniffles. Let's shut down society.
Yeah. It's crazy.
It is.
I wonder though, if this behavior, this recent behavior, this irrational acting by the governments over COVID and the shutting down schools and shutting down businesses and shutting down travel and all this stuff, I wonder if it hasn't planted a seed in a whole new batch of people. The government that you are living under, regardless of where you are in the world, apparently, obviously. The government is you're run by criminals and psychopaths.
Demons.
And the least scientific people all claiming to be about the science and telling you right. You're wrong. You know, we just got a 2-year hands-on experiment watching government act like maniacs.
Well, you know,
and I feel like it should just be a huge advertisement for the anarchist community.
Well, and I can't tell you how many normies have told me things like, I thought I could trust the news. I can't trust the news.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I know that I don't believe in voting anymore. I've heard all of this stuff from friends, family. I've seen people who were like as solid a normie as you could get that are now listening to things that they never would have listened to before. Because people are looking for an explanation, a why. Why is this way? What can I do to survive this? People are looking. And the government's not really providing any palatable answer.
No, just more questions.
More questions.
They're certainly not giving us any reason to be hopeful. The media has exposed themselves as being completely open to purchase by the pharmaceutical industry. And yet, then they float this idea on social media a week or so ago about, you know, let's talk about amnesty. It's like, wow, we're really far away from talking about amnesty.
About amnesty.
I assure you, we're not going to start with that conversation. That is,
I think that dissuading some of us from hangman's nooses versus imprisonment versus fining is really where this discussion is at right now.
Right. Yeah. They're talking about amnesty. We're talking about the gallows. You know,
right.
That's our starting position. We understand
exactly.
Where theirs is, but let me explain where ours is. Ours is all the way at the end after what you did to us. But I wonder though, man, I wonder if it's just going to backfire. You know, I feel like you have JFK, you have 9/11, you have COVID.
Right.
These transformative events in American history that are at their core, there's huge questions about the validity of them. And the media drives that narrative on all of them. And you think the normies think about JFK one way because of the media. And they think about 9/11 one way because of the media. And they think about COVID, same thing. And when you dig into it, you realize there's problems with all of the stories.
Right.
And if it wasn't for the media propping up and creating this narrative, the official story wouldn't make any sense anyway.
Well,
you know,
let's focus in on COVID for just a second and what you're saying. My observation, even now, after all the 2 years of indoctrination, is that there's really only 20 to 30% that seem like they believe what they're hearing.
Okay.
It's the mass of everyone else. They comply, but it's very clear they don't believe what they're hearing.
Is that cultural?
I think to some extent it's cultural.
Go along to get along kind of thing. We're not going to rock the boat.
You know, that's a tough call because some people say that everyone in Asia is a conformist. And my observation is that these people have anarchy written right into their DNA.
They're distrustful of the government. I know that.
Absolutely.
Coming off of the Marcos Aquinos and the world. I mean, and rightfully so. Okay.
A lot of what you hear about here is not true. So, for instance, whenever Marcos was in office, he actually only was able to keep control of the country for 2 years.
Really?
Yeah, all my friends were, and these people up here in the mountains were all pro-Marcos people. And they said, you know, for the first 2 years, nobody jaywalked. They were all afraid. But then they said slowly after the second year, it slowly started to go back to the way it was before Marcos was in office.
And what was that? More lax,
more lax, chaotic, you know, that he actually didn't control the country. He controlled Manila and he didn't control
the media went, right? So the media is, yeah, okay.
Yeah. So, and I think that the U.S. in some ways is very similar, because you talk to people in rural Colorado, which I actually had someone working with me in rural Colorado for a while. He's like, oh, my local sheriff. He said, I know my local sheriff. And he said that he talked to him about the people complaining or reporting people who were violating protocols. And this sheriff told him, whenever we get those calls, we tell them we don't have enough manpower to enforce protocols. Sorry. Good. So, you know, it's cities. Cities are where this stuff happens, where it gets enforced. But once you get out into the periphery and out into the countryside, yeah. No more. Yeah. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of doubt about all major topics. So 9/11, I remember surveys in the 2000s, in the 2010s, mm-hmm. That said that 90% didn't believe the official story.
Good.
Now, that doesn't mean that they understand it the way you do.
Right. No. I fully understand that, because that's a evolution of you know, that takes a while right. to sort of.
It can take years.
Years. Yeah. Yeah. And I wouldn't even pretend to have 9/11 100% figured out. It is,
oh, no.
It is a gift that keeps on giving. I got randomly seated at a friend's wedding next to Richard Gage from Architects and Engineers for 9/11.
Richard's Truth. A sweetheart. I love Richard.
He's the greatest guy. And I felt so yeah. bad, because I just talked his ear off the whole night, but I asked him a million questions about it. You know, I mean, I wanted to know everything. I was like, you don't understand, Richard. Like, I wrote a book, and there's a chapter in the book that's called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Like, it's about you. He's like, I'm flattered. I'm like, I have questions, you know? So it's like, there's still more that you can always learn about that. But the point is that, like you said, people are at least starting to ask questions. You know, they're going, this doesn't really make sense. So why am I looking at the picture of the politician with all the second grade kids, and all the second grade kids have masks on, but the politician doesn't, you know? And people are going, this seems disingenuous to me. And you're just like, okay, good. Go with that thought. You're almost there.
And I'll tell you, the irony that I see is the same thing happened everywhere. The same contradiction happened everywhere. There was a scandal about parties with no masks here.
Oh, was there?
Yeah. About the same time, the same scandals happened with Newsom in California and everywhere else. So this is where you kind of scratch your head and say, okay, I don't believe everything's planned, but
we want you guys to go out and get caught without your masks on, so that we can have the population going after you a little bit.
I don't know. I mean, part the more normal part of me says, oh, that's ridiculous. But then the wingnut side of me says, no, maybe that's not as ridiculous as we think it is.
there is a part of psychological traumatizing that goes into that it is like, no, I am telling you, you are going to be wearing the masks and I will not. Or the picture right. of all the G8 where they're all out there and without the, you know, with their masks on in the picture, and then as soon as they're done with the picture, you know, it's on video, they're all taking their masks off and they're all walking
and they're hugging one another
and they're doing all that stuff. And you go, okay, that's why are we being shown that? I understand that that's happening. I knew that was happening. They didn't need to show me that. I knew these people were hypocrites. But why am I allowed to see the video of them being hypocrites? I started questioning that. I was like, is it because they're sloppy, or is it because they secretly want to rub it in our faces?
Well, given the tendency for secret societies and people wanting to be like special and in the know, I would say that rubbing it in our faces is likely.
I think you're probably right.
I can't prove it, but lot of similarity. It's like, is the zeitgeist that strong that every major country had a strong man, quote unquote, strong man leader come around the same period of time? So you got Trump, you got Duterte, you got, you know, all of these quote unquote strong men. They're all about the same time. And I mean, come on. You can install leaders in countries. I know I had an expat friend here that I'll never know actually what his real job was, but he was odd fish. And he was here for, let's see. He said he came to the Philippines as a soldier in the 1968, something like that.
Yeah,
he died right before the lockdowns, and he had a brain tumor. Said he got it from Agent Orange because he was between all over Southeast Asia, and right. He told me before martial law got installed that. Here in the under Marcos, he told me, he said, I was working on one of the coastal cities, and Lady Bird Johnson had a business making pontoon bridges for Vietnam.
Really?
This is his story. I don't know if it's true. And the local mayor would dress up with a handkerchief and guns and would hold up the payroll every week. And his boss was calling back to the U.S. saying, what am I going to do about this? I'm going to have to get payroll again. This crazy mayor keeps holding up my payroll. And he was told, don't worry about it. We're installing Marcos in 6 months. You won't have any problems after that.
Jesus.
And 6 months later, there's Marcos.
I know it happens. I know it happens. I just was talking to John Perkins, author of The Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Because he used to work with presidents, and he would explain to them the deal was you've got to take these deals that we present to you. You know, we want to build a dam in Ecuador, and you don't take this loan from the World Bank, you know, we'll get somebody in there who will, because it's part of a plan, you know, like to get them into indentured servitude to the banks. And you realize, like, holy crap, you know, they fully control who is in charge of these countries. And he would explain who gave him his money. He said, oh, it came from USAID. I go, well, that's a regime change operation. He's like, yeah. They'd give him the money to fund a study, and then he'd do the study, and he'd say, well, this, according to the study, this is this country, the best thing to increase your GDP is to do this. And then they'd go approach the president and say, we think you should do this. And if the guy says, I don't want to do this, then he blows up in a plane crash.
Right. Right. Which incidentally happened here before Marcos, one of the presidents before that, mysterious death in a plane crash.
that's an economic hitman getting them. And that's the crazy thing is that John Perkins is explaining in this book. I mean, his book changed my life. It just turned me. I just went down a totally different direction after reading his book. But he explained how he would tell the guys, like, if you don't take this deal, they will send the jackals after you. And the guys knew what that meant. And those were the CIA connected hitmen.
Right.
And then, you know, he'd explain it to this guy, and the guy says, I know, John, I know. I can't do it to my people. And then he blows up in a plane crash, you know? It's fucking crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
But that's like, that's how it's like when you know that's how the world really works, it's hard for me to have this sort of energy for elections. You know what I mean?
True. Oh, absolutely. I'm on the same page. I'm on the same page. For me, before I met Perkins on reading, seeing his interviews, I had a relative here that is he's about 10 years older than me, and he was elite special forces and trained Fort Bragg. You know, it was joint training between here and there. That's a Filipino cousin, or yeah. And he was telling me about all of the stuff that they did whenever he was in operations. Well, fast forward 10 years, and I find the material of James Corbett and Sybelle Edmonds on Gladio. And everything that they were describing about Gladio was what he was telling me 10 years before they were trained to do.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I've done a whole episode on Gladio too. You know, the sort of ends justify the means mentality is just, it's psychopathic, man. And it's hard for me to it's hard for me to think like that, but I have to read it and I acknowledge that it's true, but it's like, God, you know, like go into this, you know, a strategy of tension. Like, what kind of an asshole do you have to be to come up with a concept of the strategy of tension, which involves randomly going into grocery stores and shooting a bunch of women and kids?
Yep. Going into the countryside and putting gasoline over people's houses and saying, if you don't pay me money, I'm going to burn your house down. Or as your graduation ceremony, holding up a bank, kidnapping the child of a wealthy person. This is graduation criteria. If you pulled the operation off, you graduate.
Jesus.
Yeah. And they didn't actually publicly say we're going to stop doing that until like 1999.
We are in a sick world.
Well, no doubt about it. Definitely we are.
But, if I got to be stuck in this world and you've got to be stuck in this world, I'm glad I know you. That's Matt Rainer, well, everybody. Where's the best place for people to find you? I know you do it. You wind up on a lot of other people's shows too. We're always happy to have you on Union of the Unwanted. Plug away, please.
Contentsafe.co. My company, my mother company is anomalousdesign.com. An anomalist is a person interested in difficult and unusual cases. And that's what we've been doing since 2007, helping people with small and large problems find solutions through information technology and just plain old common sense and thinking.
Well, we appreciate your work. You're saving people's asses in the alternative media, that's for sure. And we certainly do appreciate that. I'll have Matt's links in the show notes. So if you need them, they'll be there. If you want to follow me on Twitter at macroaggression, the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Thank you so much, Matt. You're the best. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Charlie.
All right. Talk to you guys later. See you, everybody.